Hello again, I'm Peter Bruce, and this is this week's edition of my series podcast From the Edge, available to you on the Financial Mail website and also on the Apple and Spotify podcast platforms. Podcast From the Edge, as I see it, is my opportunity to become less of an idiot by learning something completely new every week. I was looking back the other day at the guests we've had, and I just know I've been enriched by everyone. And my guest today is Wandi Lesi-Global, the chief economist at the Agricultural Business Chamber of South Africa and the author of a really, really good book called Finding Common Ground, Land, Equity and Agriculture. I know this because I read it before publication in order to provide a little comment on its back cover. He's also a visiting fellow at the Wits School of Governance. He did agricultural economics at Fort Hare and an MSc in the same as Stellenbosch. He's on President Cyril Ramaphosa's Presidential Economic Advisory Council, served on the Presidential Expert Advisory Panel on Land Reform and Agriculture between 2018 and 19. He's also a member of the Council of Statistics of South Africa and a commissioner at the International Trade Commission of South Africa. He's also much more important than any of these things. He's a columnist for Business Day. So there's no end of things to talk about, Wandile, but my primary ignorance, which needs fixing, is farming, closely followed by land reform. My latest interest, as you will know, is in the use of import duties to protect what seems to me to be the South African business establishment, but we might be able to get to that later. For the moment, I remember reading at the end of last year or early this year that South Africa has just become the second largest citrus producer in the world, which seemed to me to be unbelievably exciting. And it sort of just shows you, doesn't it, what we can do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we still have a potential, Peter, to even do more than that. There's area for expansion in the Eastern Cape, in KZN, in Limpopo, and I think we can still grow and excel more in our agricultural exports and also just on a job creation. And I mean, you remember, Peter, at the end of last year, there was that announcement of about 700,000 hectares of land that will be given to beneficiaries, people. And obviously that, when it progressively come into production, I think it would be excellent in addition to that, those exports and the value that we already get from agriculture. But the state also has about roughly 2 million hectares of land that if the authorities decide to give that to people, that could make meaningful impact. I'm hoping that will be part of the next release that the state will probably consider in an effort for job creation and just boosting agricultural exports.
One of the great things that you do, and I see it mainly on Twitter, is that you constantly update your audience, which is quite large now, about how well we're doing along the way. And it's wonderful because it's really always good news. Our exports seem to constantly be growing and our crops seem to be constantly doing well. Obviously, there are now and again and in various parts of the country periods of drought and hardship. But fundamentally, we can more than feed ourselves and we can more than feed bigger export markets. When you talk about rural areas, coming into Transkei or Limpopo, KZN, is there anything that we can't grow? I mean, you know, let me put it another way. Should we be concentrating on certain fruits and vegetables to grow rather than others? Are we wasting our time doing certain things?
Yeah, I actually, Peter, just before getting into that question, I think one of the things we need to really appreciate is how excellent our agricultural sector has been. I mean, there gets to be a lot of talk, some slightly negative, understandably so, when there's pessimism either about the land policy or any discussions that are around that. But if you look at the sector from 1994 up until to today, and you look at the agricultural output, you look at the money that has been spent on machinery, money spent on various inputs in the sector. I mean, the value has more than doubled since 1994. Employment has remained relatively at good levels, just under 1 million people working in primary agriculture. On agro-processing, we've seen a massive expansion over time. So we have been really doing well. And I think to your point of to say, what can we really expand on more, or what can we focus on more? I think there, I mean, we have to obviously always, when we think about agriculture expansion, and think of it in a context of what are some of the problems that we are facing. And in a rural side of South Africa, we're facing the issue of rising unemployment. There's a bit of hopelessness in some of the other areas. And obviously that through the lack of economic activity. Then when you're thinking about agricultural expansion there, you have to think about what crops can actually be of high value, what crops can create most jobs, and also what value chains can really be able to bring some livelihood, boost livelihood in those communities. And that gets to be the horticultural space. And there, I mean, it's vegetables and fruits. But obviously, not most of South Africa can actually do that. In fact, large areas of South Africa are really more for grazing and livestock. And that's where then we consider the agroecological conditions of various areas. But I think as priority to your question, it's really about horticulture that needs to be priority in certain areas of the country. And if that doesn't do well, then you begin exploring all other crops.
There are two things I want to, I'm interested to hear in. One is land reform, or the reform of land that is not occupied by black farmers, either owned by white farmers or either not used at all or either owned by the government. And as you say, there's somehow, we've got to find a way to release this onto the market. I just wonder if there's a way of addressing land reform such that it creates, instead of just creating, you know, 300 owners of very large farms or whatever it might be, or 400 or 1,000, is it possible to create 50,000 owners of smaller, more compact farms that somehow cooperate with each other? I mean, if you look at a map, a satellite map of Spain, where I worked for a long time, along the Mediterranean coast, north and south of Alicante, which was a Republican area in the Spanish Civil War. And Franco punished the Republicans for 40 years after that. They had less rights than black people did in South Africa. No taps, no education, they had nothing. And with the coming of democracy, what they did was extraordinary. They were peasants, these people. And what they did was they began to grow vegetables and fruit under plastic. And if you do, and each one has their field, it has just been the most unbelievable success, because what you can do now, because everywhere that they did this, the Spanish government built an airport, and you can now pick a tomato from your patch in Alicante on a Thursday, and it will be in Marks and Spencer in London on Saturday. Because it's a direct flight from Alicante or wherever it may be. And I just wonder whether we can't crowd in. It's not a job creation, it's an employer creation or an owner creation. Is there a way of densifying ownership on smaller patches of land?
I think, Peter, that's the discussion that, many people, if you listen to Ben Cousins, for example, at University of Western Cape, you listen to some of the scholars also from the continent, that discussion has been coming out to say, why don't we create as many smallholder farmers as we can and make sure that then the land benefits as many people as possible instead of a few rich black guys that get these land parcels. But there are a few issues there. I think, I mean, if South Africa had good weather conditions, good climatic conditions, like what you see in Spain and what you see in parts of Asia, that would be possible. But the challenge which we are sitting with, I mean, South Africa is a fairly dry country. You actually don't have much land to move around on. More than two-thirds of the country is pretty much for grazing and stuff. So the minute you begin focusing more on small farms, your productivity gets to be a challenge onto that, yeah. Which is why people end up having the bigger farms that you do see all across the country. But what I think we can improve on, though, is on a beneficiary selection of who gets to benefit on the land.
Yeah.
I use the word where I was saying black guys because that's what actually has been happening well, since 1994, where you get few rich black folks benefiting on the land. And there's studies, again, from Western Cape University and other people that are speaking about that. But I think now going forward, we need to be clear on saying, how do we select the people that actually have interest on that land parcel, but also we are more biased towards young people and also women who have been disadvantaged for quite some time. And this is a point that we reflected on when we were writing the presidential land reform and agriculture report. And that obviously led up to the beneficiary selection criteria policy, which is now coming on into government legislation stuff. And even on the land parcels, the 700,000 hectares, I think they will be using in part some of the ideas from there. But I think going forward, it need to be more aggressive onto that. But in as far as the small farms, Peter, I also do think that we need to be deliberate on creating commercial black farmers. Because if you look at South Africa's food sector right now, black people make up between 5 and 10% of the output of crops. And that causes a lot of bit of discomfort in some parts of society. And I do think that emphasizing on a commercialization will assist in large part if you deal about with the political economy of farming.
Yeah, look, I wasn't trying to suggest that, you know, we crowd all of the want-to-be black farmers onto small little patches of land. And I perfectly understand that, you know, the need to have big black farmers as well. But there are so many people, you know, what I didn't want to see really is agriculture being used or land reform being used as a sort of job creation program. I mean, I'm interested in ownership. I was just very, I remember being impressed and moved by the way the Spanish were able to do it. But Wandile, you and I take the same route down from Johannesburg, or we have, I don't live in Joburg any longer, down to our home province in the Eastern Cape. And we see the same things, and this, we have the same feeling in our chests of, you know, the sheer potential of it all is just mind boggling. And if you go there at the right time of the year, it's green, you know, it does rain there. It doesn't not rain in Transkei. It doesn't not rain along the wild coast. It rains all the time in Pondoland. Pondoland is so deeply green, it's breathtaking. And there's so much, and it does rain in northern KwaZulu-Natal, you know, and it just seems to me that there is so much opportunity, but we don't always understand the problems in getting it done. You know, I'm sure on land there's, you know, that there's traditional leadership is difficult and ownership is difficult. I'm sure you know too, Gloria Sarobi and Whiphold have got a big project going around near Willowvale. And it's taken an enormous amount of time to get farmers to cooperate with each other and to trust one another and to trust the system how difficult is it going to be? We'll start with the 700,000 hectares that you spoke about earlier. This is the 700,000 that is going to be made available to black farmers. Where is it going to come from, and how will they become owners of the land that they're on so that it can never be taken away from them?
Yeah, Peter, I mean, you're raising important points there because, firstly, on the Transkei situation, there's a great potential there that we're living in that area, and it's been like that for decades. And I think that if there could be concerted effort in really addressing the infrastructure needs of the province, but also promoting more of a joint venture approach type of development amongst those that are in the traditional leaders that are in the province, if they can work with agribusinesses and many other people, I do think that we could see some of improvement there. And I actually worry a lot about, because I mean, you will remember, Peter, back in 2012, BFAP, the Bureau for Food and Agricultural Policy at Stellenbosch and Pretoria University, they came up with a study where they were estimating that in the coming years, we will lose roughly about 1 million tons of maize that we get in Mpumalanga because of the expansion in mining and other environmental activities in them. And their suggestion was that we're supposed to be expanding more in that Eastern Cape area, the Transkei area. And since then, 2020 today, there hasn't been much progress aside from areas in the Northern Transkei. Now, and I think that we do need to pay attention on that, especially if you're looking at also the levels of unemployment, the levels of poverty in those areas. To the second point about the 700,000 hectares that is in there, I mean, my criticism to government was that this land is made available to people, but again, we are giving people long-term leases of about 30 years, non-tradable leases. And obviously then the issue of a challenge of financing these farms is going to continue to be sitting on
yeah.
And I think that the approach should have been maybe after 5 years, we make sure that people have a right to buy on that land and then they can be able to access private capital and all other activities. And the land, Peter, some of it is actually occupied by people. So government will really be doing more of a formalization. But there is some of the new land parcel that is sitting on the state hands that will be given to new beneficiaries. And I think my interest is also largely more on the other 2 million hectares that the state is sitting with to say, how can you, in a more effective way, ensure that there is a fair transfer of that land, but also people get land rights or long-term tradable leases. And the process, you work with agribusinesses and the other people to crowd in capital so that at least it's productive after that transfer and we don't sit in this cycle of land reform farms that are failing. And I'm hoping that I do think to a certain extent when one speaks to policymakers that the sentiment is changing. I do hope that in the future, they can be more aggressive on giving up the land rights.
You're very polite about policymakers, Wandile, and you're lucky, actually, because you work with arguably the most competent minister in the government, in Toko Dudiza. And she's fabulous. And I just wonder whether you ever see any sense of frustration, perhaps, on her part with her colleagues. Because I remember there was I don't know how far it got, but there was certainly an idea being spoken seriously about by the Chamber of Mines a few years ago, where they were prepared to basically hand over all the surface area under which they mine to black farmers. And they would not only make the land available, but they would finance the setting up of farms, finance the setting up of networks of transport and you know, what they like to call the value chain. And I think it all went south after the land, the changing the constitution to allow for land reform without paying for it came into being. People lost heart. People thought that there was a silly thing to have done. But I've been quite impressed, I've got to say, and I'm interested in your opinion. Cyril Ramaphosa has, in a way, finessed this debate quite nicely, because we now have a piece of legislation coming up. I think the period of commentary is over. Maybe it's been extended. But it's interesting watching how low-key and how subdued are the complaints about it now compared to initially when the constitutional change was first raised. What has happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think COVID happened, Peter, because heading to March last year, that's where the constitutional framing was actually, the constitutional committee was going to announce their view onto this. And obviously it was going to be tabled in parliament and many discussions were going to happen after that. But I mean, I do share your sentiments that since the pandemic happened, that discussion sort of like went under the radar. But I'm actually a bit more nervous now that he might come back, and I worry that he will come back and derail some of the processes. As we speak right now, the Department of Agriculture and private sector are completing the agricultural and agro-processing master plan. And on paper, the master plan is really positive in a sense that it spells out all of those areas we're talking about, for example, that have potential for development. It outlines what value chains we could focus on, job potential, and there's also some bit of enthusiasm even amongst some of our members at Agbiz, the agribusinesses, to participate onto this. So the hope now, this will be launched sometime at the end of this month. But at the same time, around the end of this month, the committee that is dealing with the adjustment on Section 25 of the Constitution, with a mandate to make explicit what is implicit in the Constitution, will also be tabling their view right after probably the launch of the master plan. And my worry is that if that discussion comes up and it gets heated and ugly again, it might actually derail us from that spirit of these master plans, which we do hope that they might bring some life in rural economies. So I'm sitting at a point where I'm really a bit more concerned about how these events will all unfold and how will various partners that are involved in a debate engage in this discussion. And obviously my personal preference, and even an organizational perspective, is that there shouldn't be any changes on their constitution. And I think you've seen that in various writings that we've put out over time.
Yes. Yeah. To what extent is government the problem? I mean, in terms of just being able to get to move from writing the solution down on a piece of paper and actually getting it done. I mean, I love the piece you did, one of your columns. I'm sure it was last year. Last March or so. And you say you started writing about some issues that were close to your heart. One such topic is the untapped agriculture and agro-processing potential of the Eastern Cape and other former homeland regions of KwaZulu-Natal and Limpopo. But the drive I take each December from Pretoria to the Eastern Cape is a constant reminder, not only of the potential, but also the poverty and unemployment that plague the provinces. And you say a few years ago, I'd hoped that by the end of 2020, some of that potential I and many others have written about would have been realized, or there'd be work underway to realize the potential. And you say you put your hopes in the election of Oscar Mabuyane as the premier of the province, hoping that he would get something done. But you say that it might be a mistake to prejudge whether he's followed through on his promise. It would have been encouraging to see how Eastern Cape plans practically to lean on agriculture as part of the recovery strategy from the current pandemic. And you don't have that. You still don't know, do you?
Yeah, it's a difficult situation. I still don't know. I still don't fully know. I mean, he made a speech about 2 weeks ago. You probably saw him just a day after the SONA or so in Parliament. And they made pronouncements about how he thinks about agriculture in the province. But I mean, the bottom line story is to actually see the actual plans, but also see the department engaging with some of the people on the ground. I mean, I drive around the province. You speak with people in like Jeff Avery at Emma Velo, dairy farms, and you speak with people like the co-ops in Humanstop and many other players in the province. And I mean, folks are not entirely happy about many things that are happening. So had the department started engaging with those private sector players, thinking about involve the communities, and the traditional leaders, and be proactive on putting out that information about what they plan to do going forward, one would have some bit of hope. But maybe there is a planning process that is underway. I look forward to see what really they put out onto. Yeah. But they are sitting on a gold mine in agriculture relative to other industries that they have in them.
Come back to products again. So we're number two in the world now in citrus. What is it, citrus production or citrus exports? I can't remember what the...
We're number two on citrus exports, but also, I mean, on production, we are also a significant player.
Okay. So what else can we go, you know, get into the top three bracket, and that's what, in terms of product, what are we really good at? I mean, avocados are now beginning to... I mean, people are shooting each other about avocados in places like Mexico. Even here, I believe it's now become target of crime. But avocados are surely a real growth industry for us. Do you have to have a large, huge 30,000 hectare farm to do this, or could you get 10 people each having slightly smaller farms putting their parcels together?
Yeah, I mean, you can have relatively smaller parcels, a few hectares for one person, and then put all of that together. And in fact, for all the horticultural side, I mean, you don't need that much land, as it's the case in the grains and in oil seeds. But I think if you look, I mean, on the world, and you look at all of the horticultural space, in fact, in all the major fruits, South Africa does feature one way or another within the top 10 of all of that. But in agriculture, in aggregate, we are around about the 32nd biggest agricultural exporter in the world. But still, I mean, for a country of our size, it's a massive contribution. And that's roughly on a year, like last year, it was about $10.2 billion or so, up 3% from 2019. So we are doing relatively well. And I think that if we can look at all the land supply, either sitting on private sector or government that is not fully utilized, and we think of the way of putting all of that in food production, we could do really well. And I think that on jobs, job creation, there's also massive potential. It's not wrong that the president keeps mentioning agriculture as amongst the sectors to development. But I think what needs to happen now is that follow-up, which you were saying, I'm being relatively fair to policymakers, are doing that if they can really progressively drive this, not only in Pretoria, but the message should be consistent between Pretoria, Bisho, and Mthatha. Because I can tell you now, if you could sit in the conversation here, and then you drive to sit with the province, then you go to Mthatha or Lusikisiki, you listen to conversations that are happening. They're usually not in the same rhythm about what is being prioritized and what needs to be done. And I think that if in all those three spheres of government, we can have a consistent messaging, but also rely on private sector. And I keep bringing this point back because of the resources that I know that are there, on the know-how, but also on the capital side, which I think that government should somewhat really tap into those resources and that goodwill that does exist in the sector on seeing rural economy develop.
If you're sitting in Pretoria or Job or Gauteng and having those discussions, then you're going to Lusikisiki, where my mother was born, by the way, and having a similar conversation, and you say the two don't really match. Where's the problem? Is the problem the centralization, the central decision-making, or is the problem in Lusikisiki?
I think the problem tends to be down in Lusikisiki, in a sense that, and perhaps maybe on a communication side, if Pretoria could be more active, or at least on channeling their message to the colleagues that are on the ground, and then encourage them to interact then with those communities and those agribusinesses. Because, I mean, people hear and we write about it, you write about it on Business Day and everywhere, and then all of these agribusiness bosses, they read about this social combating. But if when they go to their local towns to actually engage with the officials, they're not getting the same warmth that the president shared, and many people have commented about that. That is, it's always a disappointing space. And I do think that that's the area that we need to make sure that it gets corrected. And obviously, another big challenge in some of these areas is the story of infrastructure, which I think if it's not addressed, it's going to be difficult to fully bring those areas into full production.
I hate to say this, but I remember growing up in the Transkei during the apartheid years in the 60s and 70s, but mainly the 60s. And not far from my house lived a guy called Hans Abraham. And Hans Abraham was the Commissioner General of Transkei. And whatever he said, you did. That's how it worked. And the roads, the dirt roads were all perfect. Everything, the sides of the tar road, the infrastructure was maintained meticulously. And I just wonder whether the structure that we've created under democracy may not have been a little bit too out of our kind of you know, out of our reach. To have provincial governments implementing decisions into the far reaches of their corners. And the Eastern Cape, by the way, is a massive province, you know, and a complicated place, as you well know. I just wonder sometimes whether it wouldn't serve us to go back to that old model of command and control, where Hans Abram would get a call from Pretoria to say, Commissioner, hey, you know, we are now going to do X and Y. Please report. And of course, he would do exactly as he was told, and everybody would do as they were told down the road, and it would work, you know, to the extent that apartheid required it to work.
Mm. So I think, Peter, I mean, things like that might actually work, because we've been dancing around these problems, talking about challenges of the local governments. I mean, I was just reading yesterday on Business Day an article by my colleague at Stats SA, David Everett, who was actually talking about the same challenges of the local government and maybe exploring some of the effective ways that were done by the previous regime might not be a bad idea. In fact, in agricultural development, myself and Professor Yvonne Kirstin and the late Professor Mohamed Karan were actually saying in developing agriculture, we also need to look back into some of the ways that were applied by previous governments in developing the current white farmers. Either it was the production schemes or whatever, and see what idea we pull from there, which could be useful for development of today. And I think the same method for local government, studying what was effective in the past and bringing some of the useful concepts for today, it might not be a bad idea, because we are failing at this moment.
Do you know, because I don't know, because I've not really looked at it hard enough, whether in Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma's district development plan, I just wonder whether or not the district development model, if you understand it, might be of some help. I'm not sure what the district development model that Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma is responsible for is, whether it could answer it. Is it about perhaps forming like what the Americans have? They have counties in each state. So you would have a county sheriff and a county this and a county that, rather than each town having, you know, the problem, you know what Mthatha looks like and what a mess it's become. And that's partly because all the people who own the land in Mthatha don't live there. They live in Joburg and Gauteng, and they rent out to people who have to take no care of the environment around them because it doesn't belong to them. Are you an expert, Wandile, in the district development model?
No, I mean, I'm just a farmer. I do hope that we get some useful ideas there, Peter, because, I mean, there are smart folks like our colleague at Business Day, Ayabo Matawe, who's also sitting at the Presidential Economic Advisory Council. I mean, he has been thinking deeply about these issues about this the district development model. So I look forward to see what will be the final plan onto this. But I think what gives me hope is that there are people that are solid and working and looking into this. As to what they will end up coming with, I have no idea. I focus more just on rural and farming issues.
Yeah. Come back to if we can, as jumping from one of your interests to another. You're on, I think I said, the you're a commissioner on the International Trade Commission of South Africa, ITAC. And ITAC, for listeners who don't know what it is, and I'm going to describe it inaccurately, but ITAC is where you take your complaint about import competition, imports being dumped in your market at below the prices at which they'd be sold in their home market, and this is unfair, and ITAC then will take action to protect you. I've been writing lately and having some fun, and people have gotten very excited about it because excited good and excited bad. Because there's a rash of new duties coming out of ITAC on steel, on certainly regulations on textiles, on peanut butter, on aluminium, on There's a new one. No, I was going to say copper, but that's a scrap problem. Somebody's just applied. Oh, Bell Equipment has just applied for protection. It's almost as if President Ramaphosa has another leg of his business rescue, his COVID business rescue problem. You know, either you can take from the 200 billion rand loan guarantee scheme from the banks, or just go to ITAC and get some duties, and we'll take your competition away from you. Do you feel this? Am I completely insane here, or is there something going on that that the public is not aware of? Why are there so many duties being certainly asked for? I mean, they're not being given yet in all circumstances, but there's certainly been a raft of them.
Yeah, I mean, you've started an exciting conversation there. I saw the SAFER, the Steel and Engineering Federation, writing to you yesterday or this morning's paper, something. So the conversation has been extremely interesting that you started. But I think, to your point, I think the things there, Peter, are in two levels. And it's good that you have stimulated that discussion. But I think the first point is some of the companies maybe might have been having some of the challenges or complaints and sitting on them around trade policy for a while. But I think with us now being on a COVID and obviously everyone looking at all aspects that can make their business as efficient as possible, then obviously they are taking a clear look and saying, okay, what is unfair? What can be corrected to ensure our efficiency as a company? That might be one of the reasons why many applications are going to ITEC. But obviously at ITEC, when we receive some of these, we have to apply our judgment on all of the empirics that are in there. We do proper due diligence and looking at at all of these aspects, the bigger team that is there at the offices. And as commissioners, we apply, I think, an independent and a fair judgment onto this. And I think all of that which you have seen being published, I think when you read those applications in details, you would agree that there's always fair assessment and fair judgment on what ends up being a final take in each and every one of the products. But obviously, some of them, you will see many being published for public commentary, because that's what the regulation and the law tells you as a commission to pretty much do. But I think what ends up being an important one is what the final take that gets to be taken at the end of that. And is there sufficient period for various views to come on the table, which I think ITEC does allow that. And then we weigh in all of that evidence and various views that are coming from many people. As I've been sitting, for example, reading and watching what you have been arguing and many people coming against you, because that gives me a sense also of what's the temperature and what are the issues that are happening in society, aside from the empirical evidence that I also have to weigh my head on with other colleagues.
Yeah. And I haven't seen the CISA letter, but it's, you know, it's the establishment, basically. CISA has always been the establishment in the steel industry. It doesn't matter who's in charge of it. And I know the guy in charge of it very well. Very last question, Wandile, if you don't mind. The Presidential Economic Advisory Council, how's that working? Has it had time to make an impact? I mean, have you been able to meet online at all during all of this, during COVID? It was launched, it was launched with a bit of pomp and ceremony when, with various foreign luminaries on it as well, and yourself, nonetheless.
Yeah, I thought you'll be thanking us and feeling our contribution to the country.
Well, I don't know what it's done.
No, a lot is being done. We have been regularly meeting, and we've been meeting with the president and also the economic cluster on various meetings. And I think the council has made a contribution in a number of things. I mean, since the start of the pandemic. And in fact, there was a physical meeting where Mariana Mazzucato and many people, and even Ngozi, that is now at the WTO, flew in the country. I think last year, the physical meeting was on the 6th of March or so. That was the last physical meeting. But virtually, we've been meeting regularly and assisting and contributing to what the president is doing as far as economy is concerned. But obviously, as you saw sometime last year when our report on the economic reconstruction and recovery was leaked, you saw what ideas we carried onto that report. But the final take is always a take of the government, because we're sitting in an advisory position, we're advising the president, and then he decides then on how to take that advice and channel onto that. But I think we have been trying.
I want to ask you one very last question, because I've been in a position, not as often as you, but once or twice, where you get asked for advice by the government. You even do a bit of work, you know, you go and study something, or you have conversations, you have meetings with a group of people, you report back to a minister, and you never see anything that you discussed. Nothing sees the light of day. And what you see eventually as a result of your conversation is so bizarre and so depressing. You just say to yourself, I will never, ever, ever do that again. I certainly know I'll never do it again, but I'm not you, you know, and I'm in a different stage of my life and a different position. But it must happen to you all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm laughing, Peter, as you're saying that, because I mean, I think that one of the things that, I mean, one perhaps maybe has to have an appreciation of is the fact that the politicians are sitting in a slightly different position than us, in a sense that they are contending with these various interests that they have to make decisions on. So when my advice will be coming in, they have to weigh it on with some of the other interests and think also about the political consideration of that, and then take a position from there. But I think in some of the spaces that one has been involved in so far, perhaps we have been a bit more lucky and we have been a bit more effective. If you think, for example, starting about the land reform one, the beneficiary selection criteria policy, which we suggested in there, is now coming on as a law. The land donations policy, which we suggested there, is coming in as a law. The entire report cabinet weighed it on, and it's influencing the government policy. And I think that even at the Presidential Economic Council, I mean, not everything that we do suggest falls in, but some of the idea we do see them coming up here now. But certainly there are some ideas, Peter, that don't see the light of day. But I mean, you have a green passport, you are young, so you just have to keep pushing. Because if you don't do, what's going to happen? You are here. So,
well, listen, just listening to you, you've had a lot better luck than I've had with the government. But you try harder than I do, I'm sure. Listen, that was really special. Thanks so much, Wandile, for giving me so much of your time. I hope we can do this again, catch up with all of your projects, because you live in a rich vein of potentially good news and possibility, and you open it up for us whenever you write. I'll be back with another interesting guest, maybe not as interesting as Wandile, at the same time and in the same place next week. Until then, thank you for listening to Podcasts from the Edge, and I hope to be with you again soon.